Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today we come to you from the great land down under, Australia, via the miracle of Skype. Thank you, Skype, wherever you are. My guest, who happens to live in the Southern Hemisphere, is Professor Denis Dragovich, a scholar and practitioner of post-conflict state building. He has worked for over a decade with various UN agencies and non-governmental organizations in conflict environments from the Middle East to Africa and to Asia, both as a country director and a technical specialist, including having led one of the largest aid programs in Iraq. He holds a PhD in political theology from the University of St. Andrews in the United Kingdom. In addition to a bevy of scholarly and policy-based publications, he is the author of the new book, Religion and Post-Conflict State Building, Roman Catholic and Sunni Islamic Perspectives, out with Palgrave this year. In addition, Denis is a regular commentator in the media on the Middle East and in particular on the Islamic State. And when he is not doing all this writing and appearing in the media, he is donning his Superman cape and rescuing hostages in Iraq, a story that we will ask him about here in a minute. Of course, all this info is posted on our website, so mosey on over and check us out at www.researchonreligion.org because we would love to see you there, even though we really can't see you on the website, but we know you are there. Denis, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, and good afternoon from Australia.
Yeah, first off, I have to ask you, because you are the first guest to live and call from Australia. We've had two other Aussie guests before, but they were up here in Seattle at the time. And it's actually Thursday where you live, even though it is only Wednesday evening here. So the obvious question that I have, and I've always been curious about this, what does the future look like? Is it so bright that I got to wear shades?
Well, I tell you what, why don't I look at the racing results and I'll send them over to you.
Oh, that would be so good. Yeah, we could make a mint doing that. One of the things I always know out here in Seattle, we're one of the last ones to celebrate New Year's Eve, and I know Australia is always one of the first ones. So I get up in the early morning and watch you guys celebrate and then basically watch it turn over for another 24 hours. One of the other things that I teased in the introduction is that you were instrumental in helping release a hostage that was held in Iraq, and I've never had a guest like that before. There has to be a great story here. So fill us in on that. What happened?
Oh, absolutely. So I was the country director for an NGO in Iraq at the time. This was early 2004, and the situation was rapidly deteriorating. The security situation had just basically fallen apart. And leading up to the early 2000s, as charity workers, you could pretty much go anywhere you like in Africa or the Middle East, wave the white flag, and people would understand that that means neutrality, independence, and you would be largely left alone. But what's happened since, I would say probably since 2001 and the invasion of Afghanistan and the attacks on New York and Washington, that there has been a perception of Western aid as being politicized. And so one of my staff was kidnapped by militants in Iraq, and it took 10 days of negotiations, going down rabbit holes, chasing individuals and groups to find out who had him. And eventually then also to find a way to get him out. At that stage, we didn't want to engage with the military or the police. We really wanted to use back channels, and it succeeded.
Yeah. Well, that's a good story. I mean, the first time, though, that you heard the news, tell us about those first few minutes. Most people, you don't live a life where somebody comes up and says, hey, some of your staff workers have just been kidnapped.
Well, it was midnight, and I knew the situation was turning sour. I was in Baghdad at the time, but this individual was down in Najaf, which is the holy city for Shia Islam in Iraq. It's home to the mosque of Imam Ali. And I had lived there for several months before, and so I was being fed this information that the situation was deteriorating. Now, I had told this young individual, I'd said, I'm going to move you to a safe house that no one else is going to know where it is other than the owner of the house and you and me. And I went to bed that night thinking, all's good, he's safe, I'm safe, we can go to sleep that night. I get a call at midnight, basically one of my staff, who's the owner of the safe house, said, this gentleman's being kidnapped. And I said, how? We put him in the safe house. As it turns out, he thought he knew better. He left the safe house and he went back to his house, where he had things that could keep him occupied, keep him busy, and a few hours after he had left the safe house, he got kidnapped. 19 armed men came with RPGs and machine guns, confronted him and took him away. So on the final day when we got him out, the first thing he said to me over the phone was, Dennis, I will listen to everything you say from now on.
Yeah, that is some lesson to learn, I guess. I don't know if he's going back to play Xbox or whatever it might have been. But always listen to your superiors. And when they say safe house, I'm usually down with that. I mean, yeah. Safe house. I love safe houses. How did the negotiations come about? You said it took 10 days. Did you have to meet shady characters in hotel lobbies or back alleyways?
No. See, in this situation, he appeared on the news, has become ubiquitous now with the men clad in black with machine guns and machetes. He appeared on a news stream like that on day three. And so since that moment in time, we were looking, well, who's got him? We didn't even know who had him. We had suspicions. We had heard rumors. And so it was really getting the word out in and amongst our network that we are humanitarian, we are not pushing a particular agenda, and a particularly a religious agenda, because that was a real concern of people in Iraq at the time, that all civilians were there were associated with some sort of Christian attitude that they were trying to promulgate. So it was really working the back channels to get to the people who had him. And I think we did get to the right people, because one of the letters I sent to the group that I thought had him was suggesting that they play the humanitarian role, that they intervene between the group that had him, which I thought was the same group as to whom I was writing to, mm-hmm. but giving them an out of all of this situation. And so that's how it ended up. Muqtada al-Sadr, who's a famous, well-known name now, intervened as the humanitarian go-to guy who solved this situation. I suspect, though, he had his hand in it, though.
Well, it turns out that was a happy ending, and I'm glad to hear that. And I can imagine you didn't get very much sleep those 10 days.
No. Fascinating life experience.
Well, that is something that happens in states that are falling apart and when there's a lot of chaos and anarchy about. And that's what we want to talk about today. Our objective is to dive into your new book, which is called Religion and Post-Conflict State Building, Roman Catholic and Sunni Islamic Perspectives. And that sounds like a pretty ambitious book, considering that state building is really a major topic in the study of political science. I want to start out, though, with some definitional terms so that we get everybody on the same page. I'm a political scientist, so I got some feel for this, but not many listeners are out there. In the opening pages of your work, you talk about state failure and then move on to state building. Please define those terms for us.
Well, fair enough. Let me first of all begin with this idea. What is common, I find, with U.S. scholars is this idea that conflating nation building and state building. So it's really important to and nation state and state and nation. I think it's really important to begin there. Not all states are nations and not all nations are states. And it's a particular thing with American media and scholarship that I really don't understand why. But there are some nations of people, such as the Kurds or the Catalans, who are have a common history, culture, language, but they don't have a state. And then there are states that don't necessarily encompass a particular nation of people. And this, I guess you could say, would be common to a lot of the post-colonial borders that were drawn up around the world, where particular tribes and communities were divided on one side of a border and another side of the border. So when we talk about, or at least when I talk about state failure, it is the failure of the institution of the state as opposed to what is the longer-term nation-building processes that have very often been considered historically, looking at how particular nations have developed and evolved. And so state building, the way I begin with it, is trying to reverse engineer state failure. So if we understand how states fail, then we can look at what are the constituent blocks that required to have states rebuilt, in a sense. And so what I've done is I've drawn on the works of political scientists who have looked at this issue and tried to then pull out from them what the critical pieces are. But just to give examples, some specific examples, if we're talking about state failure, Syria currently today, Somalia over more than a decade, Libya since a few years ago, 2011, Afghanistan certainly prior to 2001 and the latter stages of the Taliban's occupation. These are examples of what we would call as failed states or states failing states.
And how would you define that? If I had to find a failing state, you listed, I mean, Somalia is a pretty easy one. It just seems to be complete chaos there. But you mentioned Syria and Afghanistan during the Taliban time. It seemed like the Taliban were holding things together a little bit. Why would that be considered a failed state?
Right. Well, there's a bit of an argument amongst political scientists over this. Some say states fail as a result of a legitimacy failure, and others will say it results as because of institutional failure. So legitimacy failure would be most clearly, I can give the example of Gaddafi's Libya, where as far as human development indicators and the functionality of the state itself, it was very successful. It had human development indicators that were far better than most of the rest of Africa. And yet, there came a point in time where Gaddafi's regime collapsed. And that would be the prime candidate for people who argue for legitimacy failure, because in the eyes of the people in the international community, Gaddafi's regime lost legitimacy. The other example is institutional failure, and this is when the institutions of the state themselves can no longer deliver the services that are required for a functioning society. And so these are ranked often by different authors, but in general we can say that the primary requirements are security and stability is one, and the provision of basic needs. And then there are other economic development, good governance, etc., that can be seen as basic requirements for a state, but those two are the critical ones. And so what I do is I borrow from these authors and I say, I'm not going to get involved in this debate. What I'm going to look at is both legitimacy and institutional failure and bring them together and call it three primary elements for state building. And that is, we need legitimacy, we need security, and we need basic needs. And that's the basic building block from which I begin at looking at state building.
I can imagine that there's an interconnectedness between legitimacy and the institutions. If the institutions start failing and can't deliver the basic needs, and especially cannot deliver security, legitimacy is probably soon to collapse thereafter. And I could also see, though, that even if a country does deliver the basic needs and some degree of security, and Libya might be an example of this, it still just isn't legitimate. And one might be wondering if, you know, regimes such as, you know, perhaps Iran might be in that situation today. There's a lot of indications that there is unhappiness with the regime, but, you know, they're still delivering the basic goods, basically.
That's right. And so the way I take it is I'm saying it's two sides of the same coin. Now, that's just bringing them together. We can't say it's this in particular or it's not that. I'm saying let's look at all three of them. And it could be interrelated in certain circumstances or it may not be in other circumstances.
So you're a scholar on this, but you're also a practitioner. And you mentioned there's three areas that you're looking into: legitimacy, security, and the basic needs. So how do you go about doing that? Do you set up a plan at first? Do you order a kit from Lego and start putting the bricks together? How does one take a state that looks like it's failing or perhaps is failed and put it back together?
Well, from a practitioner's perspective, it's very much looking at sad to say, but it is driven by budgets. It's driven by the institution that you work within. It is a functionalist approach. So the United Nations Office for Refugees has, High Commissioner for Refugees has a particular mandate. It only works within that mandate. And so to give you an example, though, of how this can become problematic, when the international community first prepared to respond to Iraq in 2003, the fear was that there would be mass displacement. And so the agencies that deal with displacement within the U.S. government, Bureau of Population Refugee Migration, BPRM, and internationally, it's International Organization of Migration and UNHCR. So these were the organizations that were mobilized. They had partners themselves who delivered programs who were technically organizationally prepared to respond to displacement. The problem was there was no displacement. And so we were in a situation in early 2003, I came in June 2003, a few months after the initial invasion, where you had contracts, you had money and staffing all structured around the idea that it would be a mass displacement humanitarian crisis, but it wasn't. And so this is part of the practitioner's challenge in dealing with state failure is if it's immediately after a conflict, you don't know how the conflict will play out. You don't know where the needs will be, and that makes it very difficult. Now, from a scholarly perspective, what I tried to do was to say, okay, let's first of all begin on a theoretical plane. We've got the three basic building blocks, primary elements of state building, legitimacy, security, and basic needs. And what then I was looking at was to say, okay, from the perspective of different organizations, whether it's tribal groups, unions, religious institutions, corporations, it doesn't matter. Every group can contribute one way or another or influences one way or another those three basic building blocks. So charities will certainly contribute to basic needs. Tribes will probably, in most circumstances, contribute to security. Corporations or unions may contribute to basic needs. They may also contribute to legitimacy. But I specifically started looking at religion and how religious institutions would contribute to those three. They're the building blocks that I began with.
I want to pick that up in a little bit here and talk about specifically about religion, because it's something that we talked with John Reese in terms of economic development a few weeks back, and we will link back to that podcast. But in terms of just general state building, actually, I'm interested in what happened in 2003 in Iraq. You said, we're all ready for a big displacement of individuals here. There's going to be a massive migration. We got the resources in place. I guess these might be tents and water systems and things like that. And nothing happens. What did you do then? Did you just sit there and wait for people to come, or did you take those resources and somehow retool them in a different direction?
Well, you first of all look for contract modifications that allow you then to expand who your clients or beneficiaries will be. You have to be also very cautious in those circumstances what you do, because you can actually make the situation worse. Because in the Africa context, when there's displacement, usually then there are camps. And you see that now in the Middle East for people displaced from Syria. Huge camps are established. But in Iraq, what happened, it was the community itself who integrated and took on the responsibility of catering for the needs of people who were displaced. So no camps were established, but rather families' households increased in size because they all traveled to a relative or a distant cousin or friend or something like that. And now if you've got contracts that are specifically targeted to support only displaced people, because you can't just willy-nilly decide where you want to send the money, you have to abide by your contractual obligations, it becomes problematic that you would give some support or provide some sort of engagement to an individual within a household who is displaced and not to their host or not to their cousin who is not displaced but equally in need. And this can range, let's say a practical example, anywhere from making microfinance available only to displaced people, which would be terrible thing to do, through to the more immediate programmatic response, which is the provision of non-food item kits. They're called NFI kits, so maybe a toothbrush, toothpaste, a blanket, other utensils. If you give that only to one individual and yet people are in equal need but simply haven't been displaced, it can actually cause more problems than solve. And so this is where the mechanics of aid delivery become very difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine the bureaucratic rules that you might have to deal with. I think that would drive me crazy. I mean, I would just go in there and say, oh, you know, we need to distribute these NFI kits, these folks crowding into their relatives' house. Oh, looks like a lot of people need these toothpaste and other amenities kits. I'd give it to them, but then I'd probably get in trouble.
Well, I mean, but in that circumstance, you're presuming you have access to unlimited resources.
Yeah, that's
the
true.
Point is you've only got a limited amount of money and you have to decide to whom does it go.
Yeah. One other question I have about this before we move on to religion, and this is interesting. You mentioned it a little bit in context with the hostage situation that you had to deal with before. But when it comes to state building and assisting that process, who does it really come down to in terms of responsibility? And how do some nations, some people from certain nations or from citizens in a country, can separate those two types of groups out, respond to outsiders coming in and saying, hi, we're here to rebuild your state?
Well, I can answer that again from a practitioner and an academic perspective. From the academic perspective, this is where it becomes really interesting. State building sits firmly within the literature of international relations. And so it is very much biased to actions of international organizations. The focus is on foreign countries, international or multinational institutions, and how they then input their resources and expertise to rebuild a country. Now, in reality, having been a practitioner in these situations, I'm very, very aware that actually that those elements play a very small role, unless there is a situation such as in Iraq, where the United States took over the mandate of governance. And it became, in effect, the responsibility of a country of the United States, which is very rare. In most cases, the international actors are contributing to a state-building process that is driven from within. And what we tend to do, because the literature sits within IR, is ignore the local players. We ignore the role that trade unions, corporations, local businessmen, courts, and all these other bodies can contribute simply because of how the disciplines within academia are split.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you on that one. And that brings us to the next question of one of the grassroots organizations that does matter here are religious groups, religious organizations. And I want you to talk a little bit about how you came to investigate in this topic and write this book on religion and post-conflict state building, because I can say this, and I know John Reese has said this in a previous podcast, that religion and international relations, religion and comparative politics, religion and state building, nobody really looks at that stuff.
No, you're right. My path, my journey began with a particular meeting that I remember very clearly. So I was, like I mentioned, in Iraq in 2003. I was living in Najaf, the holy city full of Ayatollahs within the Shia Islam. And the Americans sent a gentleman called Ambassador Robert Ford, who was the head of the governorate of Najaf, or became the representative of the central authority of the U.S. Transitional Administration. And I had the opportunity to sit down with him and have a chat. And I asked him, are you going to be meeting with the Ayatollahs in the coming months? And he clearly said to me, he said, no, we won't be, because we're looking at establishing a secular, centralized state.
That's not going to go over well.
No. And I was, we're talking about, 12 years ago. Yeah. I was naive, unaware of the broader dynamics. I thought it sounded silly and short-sighted, but who was I to say? And so I went along with it, and so be it. I was visiting the Ayatollahs constantly because my life and security depended on it, and the effectiveness of our activities depended on it. But that stayed at the back of my mind. And then as the years progressed, certainly the U.S. and the efforts of General Petraeus seemed to recognize and acknowledge the role that religion played, tribes played, local dynamics played. Now, a lot of academia already knew that. A lot of historians already knew that. But for whatever reason, it wasn't in the policy field. It just wasn't being engaged with. And so that's what drove me to work on this topic, which is effectively to develop a model of how to consider the role of religious institutions in post-conflict state building.
And I guess for me, it seems really obvious. I've been working in this field for 25 some odd years or so, starting with my dissertation. And I understand that religious groups, churches, mosques, imams, all these different folks play a very important role in their community. They organize people, they bring people together, they give people direction, people look to them for solace in times of difficulty. It just seems that it would be odd that policymakers would turn a blind eye to a set of institutions that are just so good at organizing folks.
It is surprising me also. And I think there's a lot to be researched in that why does that happen? How is it that policymakers could overlook such an important institution? But it's not only policymakers, though. When I was doing research on this topic and going through what the World Bank or what other scholars have written, when they do talk about civil society and what comprises civil society, inevitably it ignores religion. There is always a long list of this type of body and this type of group, but never is religion included. And I found that fascinating. There's a little bit of research that talks about how religion is ignored by it's a mental taboo. That's mm-hmm. the terminology used by one scholar, a mental taboo that's not to be talked about. It's not to be included. And that's, I find that fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, you're just describing my life over the last 25 years. I hear you on that. And that's part of the reason why we bring you research on religion, because this podcast is designed to be a little bit of a corrective to that. And so it's wonderful talking to you about this. And, you know, it goes back to Robert Putnam, right, about bowling leagues. And I'm saying there's churches. We're churches in your book. So, but talking about that, you talk about the importance of religious institutions, and like as I mentioned in the introduction, you're dealing with the Middle East. You told us some stories here already in Iraq. You've been in Africa and also in Asia. The religious institutions are going to be kind of different here. So when we talk about religious institutions, or when you talk about it in your book, what do you mean by religious institutions? Who are these folks? What are they?
Yeah, so I had to narrow that down, obviously, because the title of the book is Religion and Post-Conflict State Building, which was more probably driven by the publishers than by myself. Yeah. And then I'm looking at religious institutions, and even those we have to narrow down. So an institution itself, I borrowed the work of a gentleman called Guy Peters, who studies this idea of institutions. And basically, there are three critical aspects that I try to draw upon when I'm looking at whether a religious institution is an institution in of itself. And they are. There has to be some stability over time. It can't be just an organization that comes and goes and there is no aspect of an institution to it. It has to be able to influence individual behavior. It's not as if it is just inwardly focused in of itself. And the last aspect is that it has a sense of shared values and a meaning amongst its members, that there are some values that it stands for that you can objectively put aside and separate to the individuals that make up or constitute its membership. So when we transpose that into the space of religion, I'm looking at religious institutions that have a national standing, so not small churches that may be in particular corners of a particular country, but because we're looking at state building at a state level, we need to look at similarly religious institutions at a state level. So, for example, there are some institutions such as the Roman Catholic Church, which is the obvious institution. But then when it comes to Sunni Islam, it becomes a little bit more hard to ascertain, well, where is the institution in Sunni Islam? Because Sunni Islam, if you had to compare its structures, it would be a lot more closer to Protestantism, where there is a closer and a direct interpretation of the scriptures without the need of an intermediary institution. And so with Sunni Islam, in some countries like Bosnia and Herzegovina, there is actually an institution, a registered structured institution that represents Sunni Islam in that country. In other countries, you may not have a formal institution, but the government will acknowledge a Grand Mufti, or which will then have a structure behind it. So it would be a sort of a government acknowledged and recognized body. Even in some cases, I would go as far as saying some individuals can be seen as institutions in of themselves, in that their teachings have transcended the individual opinions and have become a part of a country's culture. So there are some people who are just larger than life to such a degree that they are seen as institutions by people. So it really varies depending on the location, on the particular culture, and on the religion as to what is the religious institution to be studied.
Now, in terms of talking about all the different actors that could play a role in state building, and you mentioned corporations and unions and other groups as well. And if I asked you to put a weight on religious institutions, and obviously this is going to vary by country, I would imagine, is the role of churches, or religious institutions of primary importance? Is it a complementary importance? How would you weight that?
You're right to say that it varies from country to country, but when we're looking at state failure, inevitably the institutions that are functioning following the collapse of a state, one of them will be a religious institution. It is by the very nature of humanity that when circumstances confront us, existential circumstances, we tend to turn to religion. And based on that, religious institutions will tend to be functioning, robust, and influential within communities faced by state failure.
And that, in and of itself, should be a big, huge warning light to scholars to pay attention to it. Religions have existed for eons, and when a state fails, those religious institutions are still around. It just amazes me nobody figures that out.
that's right.
Here's another question. So, and this is, I'm very interested in this because I'm one of the people who puts religious groups into the camp of what we could call civil society. These are actors that are outside of the state. They oftentimes exist separate from the governing institutions that are there. But you're talking about state building. And so my question is, to what extent do these religious institutions assist in state building as compared to rebuilding or continuing to help civil society function? So what's civil society versus state building there?
Yep. So without a doubt, religious bodies are a part of civil society. They're not a part of the state, but they do interact with the state. Now, theoretically, in a fully functioning civil society, there wouldn't be a need for the state. If theoretically, in reality, that's not possible, but theoretically. So with a functioning civil society, you wouldn't need the state. But in reality, we don't have civil societies that are so pure that they function seamlessly. And so there are interactions between aspects of civil society with the state. And what's important to try to drill down and examine is how do they interact? How do aspects of civil society, such as religious institutions, contribute or take away from the process of state building?
So give me some examples here of how this interaction works. And I'm a nuts and bolts guy. I love just to know almost on a day-to-day basis of how this stuff functions, especially you in light of being a practitioner. And one of the case studies that you have in your book here is Bosnia-Herzegovina. And I would love to hear some stories about how you interacted and what you learned from this whole process of getting religious institutions as a part of civil society to assist in the state rebuilding process.
Sure. So I would go back, first of all, to those three building blocks that I mentioned: legitimacy, security, and basic needs, and then trying to pair up what are the unique characteristics of religious institutions to each of those three. So, for example, and since you're a nuts and bolts sort of guy, I'll give you a specific story. In Croatia, not long after its independence, which was then going through after the war of the 90s, it was going through a state building process. And there is one particular moment where Cardinal Kuharic and President Tudjman were walking to the main square in Zagreb, in the capital, and they both came up onto the podium of the stage, and in between them was the cradle and a child in that cradle. Now, the imagery there is very clear. You've got the religious leader, and you've got the baby Jesus, you've got the political leader, and you've got the baby state. This was choreographed perfectly because religion and the Roman Catholic religion in Croatia is so important that it and so valued and respected and has legitimacy. And so this, in effect, was through a theoretical process of frame realignment where the legitimacy of the church was being transferred to the legitimacy of the new political leadership. And so that's just one example of how practically the church can contribute to increasing the legitimacy of a government if it's willing to do so. Now, in other countries, the religious leaders may not be willing to convey their legitimacy. Even looking at the question of legitimacy, I think it's really important to drill down there because there are different understandings of what is legitimacy. I borrowed the work from David Beetham, a scholar in the UK, who's looked at this considerably. And what he does is he breaks down legitimacy into three aspects, and they are legal validity, so that a state can only be legitimate if it ascends to authority and wields that authority legally. The second one is justification of power, and so somehow their authority has to be nestled within a narrative that transcends generations. You can't just create the justification for your existence in authority in of itself. It has to fit within some sort of transgenerational narrative. And the last one is there have to be some sort of expressions of consent. It doesn't have to be democracy. In the Islamic tradition, there is this idea of baya, which is showing fealty to a leader. So maybe a tribal chief would come to the particular individual and bow, publicly bow in front of them, and then that shows that fealty. Now, you hear a lot about baya in Islamic State at the moment, where different insurgent groups in other parts of the world are giving baya to Islamic State, to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader. And so legitimacy has these different aspects to it. And for me, it was looking at how religious institutions can contribute to each of them separately. The other one, security.
Actually, let me pause you here for a minute. I want to come back to legitimacy, and I love the story that you told in the Croatian town square, and this was choreographed. For me, a person in the audience, and I'm somewhat oblivious to some of this symbolism stuff. You see a baby in a creche up there, and you know, first thing I would say is, "Hey, somebody get the kid off the podium because it's the kid's going to be crying. What are you doing here?" But you know, it's like, "Oh yeah, it's the Jesus birth story. It's around." Was this around Christmas or was this in July or something?
Oh, it would have been, this is drawing on my memory now because it was in the 90s.
Yeah.
I would say late in the year.
Okay.
Hard for me to say exactly.
Okay, so it's coming up to Christmas. I could see that. But did they have to explicitly draw this connection of the religious symbolism leading to legitimacy? Did somebody have to say, the president of Croatia, come up and say, "We are now birthing a new nation just as Jesus was birthed 2,000 years ago"? Or was it just subtle? It was just there on the side so that the more religious people would go, "Oh, yeah, I kind of subliminally picked that up."
I don't know how the impact turned out to work, so maybe they over-egged it.
Yeah.
I can't say. But in the Balkans in general, and it's not only with the Roman Catholic Church, with the Serbian Orthodox Church also, and with Sunni Islam, there is a tendency to seek opportunities to align yourself with that religious leader.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly with the Serbian Orthodox leaders in Bosnia and Herzegovina during and after the war, they did look to always get the blessing of the local religious leader, the metropolitan at the time. And so it does happen. It may not necessarily align with our cultural sensitivities, but in other cultures, it's very important.
Actually, it does, I think, align with our cultural sensitivities, too, because as we approach a presidential election here in the United States, and I know you have recently had some elections down there in Australia, politicians just love to be photographed walking in the churches and standing there.
Oh, absolutely.
But, yeah. And
you always, every American politician always ends the speech with, "God bless America." Now, that for an Australian is very strange. That would never happen. But it seems in your cultural context, it's accessible. And it would be odd if they didn't, I suspect.
Yeah. Well, I don't see Australian politicians wanting to bless America. Wouldn't they want to bless Australia? I mean, we're great, you know, we give you the NFL and stuff, but, you know. That is interesting. I know that a friend of mine down there, David Smith, keeps me abreast on politics, and there is less of that in Australia than there is in other places, which is an interesting topic of itself. But let's move on to the next thing. We talked about legitimacy here. How do religious institutions help in the state-building process with respect to security?
Right. So I think it was Stalin who commented with regard to Pope Pius XII. He was saying, "Well, how many divisions does he have?" And there's that ignorance as to what role religion can play in security. I came across that when I was doing my research, where people would say, "Well, it's got nothing to do with it." But actually, there are circumstances in other cultural contexts where religion does play an important role. And on top of that, you have to keep in mind we're looking at failed states. So the infrastructure of the institution of the state no longer operates. Jails may not be functioning. Police are not present on the ground. Once you have a void of power, who fills that void? In Somalia in the 90s, you may recall, it was the Union of Islamic Courts that came together. So basically the genesis of that was individual communities established court functions based around their mosque or their imam, and because they needed adjudication, they needed mediation on particular issues, whether it was business transactions or family disputes. And that eventually evolved into a network that had its own army that ended up taking control and stabilizing Somalia. In Afghanistan, 2011 Asia Foundation had a survey and found that more than half of the people surveyed thought that there was a role for religious institutions to play in adjudicating disputes. And it wasn't just family disputes, it included land disputes. So and then even going beyond religious, there was work done in Africa saying that 80% of disputes are settled through non-formal mechanisms. 80% are based on traditional, so it's not religious alone, but, you know, tribal or other different community mechanisms. So in the context of failed states where there's a security vacuum, religious institutions have emerged to play substantial roles as mediation and adjudication, as I mentioned. But two other mechanisms that I identify. One of them is building social capital, which is critical to strengthening or stabilizing a state. And the second one is promoting civic values that are associated with a civil society. And so religious institutions, by their very nature of having extensive networks into a community, having Friday khutbah, the sermon in the Islamic faith, and in on Sundays within Christianity, they can convey particular messages to a captive audience who will then listen. And so that's about conveying values. In different countries, they have huge publication and media networks. So these are all ways that religious institutions can contribute, but they don't necessarily do so, and they don't necessarily all work towards the same direction. And that's the critical point.
That's interesting that you mentioned that they don't always work together. They might sometimes be working at cross purposes, maybe intentionally, but maybe not intentionally. Is there some role that outside organizations, some of the work that you do, does to help facilitate coordinating some of these things? When you talk about, well, hey, sermons, we got to talk about building some civic values here. We're all Iraqis, or we're all Afghanis, or something like that. Is there some role that you play in terms of that, or does that develop organically in the communities?
There has been a change recently in the last half a dozen odd years where secular institutions involved in post-conflict state building or humanitarian response are engaging with religious institutions more and more so. Problematically, though, from the U.S. perspective, you have constitutional issues with federal government money going towards religious objectives. And so there are real question marks in the international humanitarian space and a real sensitivity as to whether we can engage with religious institutions. What's been happening is there have been efforts to partner with local groups to develop, for example, efforts have been made in Africa to develop sermon guides related to malaria, where you're linking aspects within the Bible or the Quran that then talk about how it's important to do certain things that will minimize your exposure to malaria. So rather than disseminating information on a secular basis, on a purely probably, let's say, technical level, saying that this disease is spread in this way and it has a higher level of mortality. Instead, it's done through the pulpit. And so that's just one example of what the partnerships that are emerging in this space.
And you mentioned malaria and disseminating ideas about how to control malaria. I mean, some of this is idea-based and, you know, setting uncertain values, and, well, maybe you have to change some of your traditional practices so that this disease doesn't spread. That gets us to that third category of state building that is very important, and that's basic needs. How do religious institutions play into this?
Well, most people will be familiar with Caritas or other arms in the United States is Catholic Relief Services, which is part effectively the U.S. Caritas version. And then there are other bodies that are associated with churches. MCC is the Mennonite Church Committee, I believe it's called. The Lutherans have their own. And these are the well-known mechanisms through which basic needs are provided or channeled through religious institutions. And a lot of research has been done by on these groups. But one of the things that I like to ask is, that's from an international perspective, but let's try to refocus once again on the domestic issue, the local religious groups. How are they contributing to basic needs? In some circumstances, if we take the Roman Catholic model, it is very integrated. So a Caritas from a foreign country can't operate in another country unless it has the permission and agreement of the Caritas in that country. And so it's a very good structure to ensure that resources are transferred, that knowledge is transferred, but in a partnership method as opposed to just coming in and overriding the efforts of any local group. But on the flip side, in the Islamic community, there aren't any single overarching institutions that play that similar role. And so in the countries that I've been involved in as a humanitarian actor or as a researcher, it's very fractured within Islam. There are no central bodies to go to. It's less organized, less connected to the international space. So, for example, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, where I did some field research for this book, there isn't a local leading humanitarian body that is then connected to international groups. So although there are a few humanitarian Muslim bodies in Bosnia and Herzegovina, they don't have access to the resources that others can get from partnering with the more wealthy international groups. And this is where it becomes problematic with regards to the structures of the humanitarian groups themselves, the religious humanitarian groups.
That's one of the things that you deal with very well in your book. You have two different sections of the book that deal with Catholic conceptions of state building and going through these different aspects, and Sunni Islamic conceptions as well, two areas that you are very familiar with because you've worked in many of these contexts. Give us some idea of how, if there are any commonalities between the Catholic and the Sunni Islamic approaches, or if there are differences. You've already signaled some of those. And then the other thing I'm interested in is, to what extent can these two different approaches to state building actually work together in some context?
It is very much a contextual-based question that you're asking here, because in my book, what I did was have a separate chapter for what is the Roman Catholic view towards state building and its role from a theological perspective, which I hope we can get to. And then I had another chapter for Islam. But then it's a separate idea to look at how it actually is implemented within the context of a particular country, because while there are the universal doctrines and perspectives of what that religion stands for, it doesn't necessarily mean that the local version itself will be adopting entirely every aspect and element of that public, universal religion. And so within different contexts, we really need to understand let's take the example of Islam. What school of jurisprudence is the prominent or dominant one in a state? So in Sunni Islam, there are four schools of jurisprudence. And even, I argue in my book, the school of theology, there being two main schools of theology, are also important to understand, because depending on which school of jurisprudence will be able to then shed some light on their views on particular aspects. So, for example, there's this question of hijra in Islam, and that is migration. At what stage are you compelled to migrate to another country? Now, the different schools of jurisprudence will answer that question differently. And yet that's really important from my perspective, from state building, because if the religious institution that is interpreting the doctrine is saying that there is no need to migrate, it's saying that you can stay because this is a part of Dar al-Islam or an intermediary. It's not a part of Dar al-Harb, which is the countries at war with Islam. So it is a place that you are allowed to stay within. Then my contention was then there are conditions upon which individuals who choose to stay, they have to follow through with some certain obligations. And so depending on the school of theology, of jurisprudence, will inform which view is taken, and then it leads to the obligations upon the people. And so that's how it's very difficult to look at it simply comparing and contrasting, because it's so specific on the locality and how it's interpreted by the individuals. You did also talk about, the second part of your question was, is there an effort for collaboration? I think that also really depends on the individual relationships and the direction they're heading. My work doesn't necessarily look at peace building. It's solely focused on state building. And so what I'm looking at is, are there mutual interests? I avoid, and I think it's problematic, to try to instrumentalize religion, which is what many Westerners would do and the military has done. They're the ones, the U.S. military in particular, has done some great research into understanding religion far better, I think, than within academia. But problematically, they do so for their own reasons, and to instrumentalize it at a tactical level. For me, it's about understanding where there is overlapping mutual interest. And to do that, you need to understand where the religions are coming from, where the Western state builders are coming from, and where even the state itself is going. Where they overlap is where you can say there's commonality.
You mentioned a little earlier that you hope we would get to the issue of political theology in light of the Catholic conception of state building. So I'll let you have at that question and give us your thoughts on that.
Right. So I touched on the Islamic perspective a little bit, but let's start then with the Catholic perspective. My book is 200-odd pages, and yet hundreds of thousands, if not millions, have been written about Catholicism and its view of aspects of the state. So I had to say there is a lot out there, but let's look at what the primary theological message is that is conveyed by the church, and that is salvation. Salvation is the overall driver. It's the dominant message within Christian belief, that Jesus died to ensure that we have access once more to redemption. Now, within salvation, there is what's known the terminology of the economy of salvation, and that is that there's access, people have access to the ability to prove themselves worthy, I guess you can put it that way. Now, if you are suffering without having any access or sufficient access to basic needs, it becomes problematic. If you are so poor and so hungry and so destitute that you cannot make choices in life to participate in the economy of salvation, then you are effectively forced to act in a way that you wouldn't otherwise. And the church recognizes this, and so it has this exemption for people who commit sins based on the actions that are beyond their control because of the circumstances they're in. It's the same with security. So if you have a situation where the security situation is so threatening and so void of any control or stability that you have to act in a way that may well breach your obligations to a good life, then this is taking you away from the path that you would be otherwise pursuing within the economy of salvation. And so from my perspective, I was trying to look at, okay, so if the objective of the church or the primary message of the church is the importance of salvation, then what role can the institution of the church play to facilitate individuals' paths to accessing salvation? And so that's where I say, okay, so from a theological perspective, we all know that God wants all people saved. Timothy 2:4, it's God wants all men saved, all men to be saved. Now, if we know that, and that's a primary telos goal of the church, then the church is obligated to contribute its resources to facilitate that process of individual salvation. So that means contributing to the reduction of those people living in absolute poverty, contributing to stabilization, less so to legitimacy. There isn't an overwhelming motivation for the church from a theological perspective to say that a legitimate authority is any different than an illegitimate authority. At least I couldn't find anything that would suggest that. It seems to be simply saying the common good, as long as an authority pursues what's in the common interest, then it is an authority that should be supported. But basic needs and security then become critical, because otherwise individuals are not able to participate in the economy of salvation. Now, that's a very simplified overview of what is an incredibly complicated topic, and I've only drawn one aspect of it. So, you know, another approach could have been not to look at salvation, but to look at a Christological process, looking at do unto others as you would want done unto you. And so that could take a whole different angle to all of this. But I pursued salvation, and that was the direction that I took with the overall approach of the theological motivations towards contributing state building. Then what I would do is break it down into each one: basic needs, legitimacy, and security.
Mm-hmm. And it is a good way how you organize this, and I can see how the political theology of Catholicism works from those basic needs to the security, and then lets legitimacy somewhat lay out where it lays out in that respect. And so we will point people back to your book, Religion and Post-Conflict State Building, for a more wide discussion and deeper discussion of that than we have here. I do want to leave off, though, in the last few minutes with a contemporary event. And you've thought about this, you've talked about it in other media outlets as well, and that's the Islamic State. And I want to start out here, because it's always dangerous for social scientists to talk about something that is very fluid in the contemporary time. And so I'll start out by saying that we are recording this on April 22nd. It's going to air in the second week of May. So whatever we talk about here, if something completely different happens, you have to forgive us in that regard. But in terms of what you have been studying, what you have been researching, and you know the area very well where the Islamic State has been advancing and taking control of territory, what are your perspectives that you bring to the table here in terms of failed states and in terms of state rebuilding? Is the Islamic State rebuilding a state within the cracks of maybe two or three failed states?
Yeah, so my commentary in general on this is we need to see Islamic State is itself doing what we've done in so many other countries, and that is state building. They are, in effect, under their own ideology, building a new state. And so it's the same approach that we've been talking about now to understand what they are going through. They are also trying to establish legitimacy. They are also trying to distribute basic needs. They are also trying to ensure that there is security. Without all of these three, they will fail. And so when I look at the issues that Islamic State is going through and how it's going about it, I look at it through those lens. The other aspect that I am very interested in is the doctrinal basis. There is a lot of discussion that this is not Islam, that they have they're not engaging with Islam correctly. And I'm not an Islamic theologian, so I don't engage in that discussion at all. But what I do look at is that at least within their belief structure, they have a common ideology and they call it Islam. Now, whether it's the same Islam as others call it, that's, again, not for me to comment on. And in, therefore, there is a movement here. It is not a terrorist group per se. It is a movement that is trying to establish a state. And these are two very different things then, because it influences how we respond to that. My experiences in Iraq and Sudan and other countries like that is that in these circumstances, then external forces are only going to entrench and empower them, because the narrative that they will create around external forces is that it's an us against them. What we need to be doing instead is trying to disentangle what we refer to as Islamic State, but it isn't simply one state. It's a coalition of Ba'athists, moderate Islamic groups, tribal groups, and various others. We need to disentangle all of those that we can work with away from those that are the extremists, the fundamentalists. And there's a large number there that we can work with. The secular Ba'athists used to be deputies of Saddam Hussein. They were not by any measure Islamists. A lot of tribal leaders supported the U.S. military in 2005 and 2006. The same groups who supported the U.S. military then against al-Qaeda then are now supporting Islamic State. If you look at ways to tear them apart, disentangle that, and then support them to undermine it from within, that's the approach that we should be taking. I don't believe that there's a military solution to be had here.
Your perspective actually adds a lot to this conversation, and I think by looking at your book and thinking about this in terms of legitimacy, security, as well as the basic needs, and putting it in light of political theology is a really useful way of looking at this thing. So I will point people back to your book on that. We are running out of time, and I always like to ask my guests one final question that allows them to do a little bit of reflection back upon the process of research that they've just conducted. And so you're publishing this book, The Religion and Post-Conflict State Building, Roman Catholic and Sunni Islamic Perspectives. It's a book that you've been writing for a while, and you've been researching and even been thinking for a longer period of time. Is there any large takeaways that you had with this research process, or anything that changed your mind or altered the way you look at the world in terms of doing this research?
I guess the one message I would convey, and I keep thinking about myself as how we got to this space, is that we need to realize that the secular world that we surround ourselves is the minority in the rest of the world, that the rest of the world finds a very important place for religion in the public space. And for us to go out into those different societies and tell them how they should be structured, or recreate them in our image, in a sense, a somewhat of a Christian view, a Christian narrative, I think that's problematic. And the sooner that we start embracing and accepting theology and different interpretations of different religions into bringing it into political science and social science and other disciplines in academia, the sooner we'll be able to better understand the causes of some of these movements and how to respond, how to engage, and how to offer solutions.
Well, that is one of the things that we always try to do here on Research on Religion. And my guest today has been Dennis Dragovich. Dennis, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.